Greetings, errants, glitches, breakaways, thought criminals, and genuinely open-minded and outright curious inhabitants of whatever simulacrum we find ourselves navigating at the moment. You are about to set sail on another free first-hour episode of The Melt. If you find yourself wanting to dig deeper and have the desire to join the conversation during our monthly Melt meetups, you might want to consider becoming a monthly subscriber. For a measly 5 dead presidents per month, you can have access to full-length, early, and exclusive episodes. Just click the Patreon or Locals link in the episode notes below to create the timeline that will set it all in motion. It's suspiciously simple, altogether painless, and just might inspire feelings of bliss and or lingering euphoria. So, without further ado, let the conversations begin!
This is Hunter Muse.
And this is Chris Snipes. And you are listening
to The Melt.
That it is good to take into account that although we might congratulate ourselves for the long hours of research that we've done and pride ourselves on the insightful conversations that we find ourselves having with people and how critically we feel that we can comprehend our surroundings and suss out the anomalies and overlaps in this realm in order to get to something that we can comfortably call the truth, that we may very well be way off the mark. I feel that it's very important to allow for a lot of wiggle room in one's perception in regards to what we think is really going on. Today's guest, writer Anthony Peake, joins us to share with us his Cheat the Ferryman hypothesis and to examine various aspects of life, life after physical death, and reincarnation. This was an extremely thought-provoking conversation. I started off by asking Anthony to catch anyone listening or watching up on a bit of his background.
I have been writing now since 2006. I've now just working on my 13th book, which will be published in the States and the UK and Europe probably towards the end of the year. I've also have a career as a business consultant as well, and that's the real job. The writing is my enjoyment more than anything else. Basically, always wanted to be a writer, and I'm delighted that a number of publishers feel the same way. I'm not self-published. I'm not vanity published. The publishers pay me, which is really rather nice. But the drawback sometimes is that they can decide on the covers of the books and everything else as well, and the layout of the books, these kind of things, which is sometimes the drawback when if you privately publish, you do have a good deal more control. But what it does mean is that my publishers have got my books everywhere. So I have at least one book in every major and most minor European languages. My last books, they had two books come out in Greek 2 years ago as well, which is really good.
Cool.
And book sales now really approaching probably 200,000 books over
nice.
The last 15, 16 years, which is quite good. So people are obviously interested in what I'm writing about. And my approach is somewhat slightly more scientific and, dare I say, slightly more rational than a lot of people in the field, or I try to keep it scientific if I can.
Yeah, for sure. I think that definitely lends an air of credibility to all the things that you discuss, some of which are pretty far out for some people. The only book that I've read of yours is the latest, which I believe to be the latest, Cheating the Ferryman.
Correct.
Yes. And I thought it was fantastic and mind-blowing, very, very well written. But perhaps we can start off, if you can tell the listeners and the people watching, what the Cheating the Ferryman hypothesis is and how you came to it.
Yeah. As I've worked in business for a million and one years, I always work on marketability of concepts. And I've always was interested in having buzz statements or marketing statements that apply to my ideas. And I was particularly proud of the Cheating the Ferryman model. And Cheating the Ferryman is the term I've used for my hypothesis ever since my very first academic paper, which came out in 2005. And Cheating the Ferryman basically goes back to the ancient Greek belief that once somebody died, they would place a tiny coin called an oboli or an obolus underneath the tongue, or two oboli over the eyes of the corpse. The reason being that when the person found themselves in the other world, the underworld, the other place we go when we die, they would find themselves on the edge of a river, and through the mist would come Charon the boatman, the ferryman. And the ferryman's role was to then ferry the dead person, the shade, as the ancient Greeks called them, over to Hades, the land of the undead. And in order to do that, they paid Charon, the ferryman, a fee, which they use the oboli to do, or the obolus to do. Now, my hypothesis states that we actually cheat the ferryman due to some interesting circumstances that take place in the brain neurologically at the point of death. I suggest that we never actually die. We die in the worldview of other people. But for us, because our time scale changes and our subjective ability to understand and perceive time changes, it means effectively that we exist in this ever-increasing final second of our lives that can expand out to cover multiple lives in one way or another. Now, again, it is intriguing that the ancient Greeks also believed that when you ended up at the other side of the river Styx and Charon took you over, you were given the opportunity of either staying where you were or drinking the waters of the river Lethe, which was one of the tributaries of the Styx and the Acheron. And drinking of the waters of the Lethe was the waters of forgetting. So effectively what the person would do would drink the waters of the Lethe, and all their past memories of whoever they were in their past disappeared. And they were allowed to go back and live their life again without the memory of knowing that they were living their lives again. And I thought this was quite an intriguing myth, because of course myths in its technical term used by sociologists of religion, a myth is something that speaks of a greater truth, and it's couched in different language so people can follow it and understand it. And I genuinely believe that the ancient Greeks, particularly the mystery schools of the ancient Greeks that was based around Eleusis in Greece itself, the Eleusinian mysteries very much had these kind of beliefs, and it was a mystical school. It was linked with altered states of consciousness, drinking a substance called kaikion, which put people into altered states of consciousness. And these belief systems then carried through into the Romans and the early Christians in a particular schismatic Christian group called the Gnostics. And I've long argued that the Gnostics have long known about these things in one way or another. So that is very basically what I mean by cheating the ferryman.
Okay. So the what you're saying about you don't die, is this, you're saying that we don't physically die, or we don't, our soul or our essence doesn't die, doesn't stop, it continues?
Okay, it gets quite technical here, but to just go back a little bit,
okay,
it's to do with how perception works.
Okay.
Now, most people tend to assume that there is an out there, which is real, and there's an in here, which is real. And we are some form of sentience, some form of consciousness that is perceiving an external world, and we share that external world with other people. Now, the people who believe that there's a one-to-one relationship between what the senses tell us is outside of us and what is actually out there, and it is the same thing, are called naive realists. That is, they're called naive realists, not by New Age weird people. They're called that by perception scientists. Because whatever is out there, it is not what we believe it to be. Everything that we perceive is inwardly generated by the brain from external stimuli. So we see things through our eyes, we hear things through our ears. But everything, say, for instance, in the visual world, everything that we believe is out there is actually reprocessed in the visual cortex, which is an area right at the back of the brain here, an area of total darkness. And what happens is, when we say we see something, what is actually happening is that a photon of light, which is a point particle or a wave, depending upon which viewpoint you have in terms of this, and we can touch on the mystery of quantum mechanics later, but let's argue that a photon is a solid bit of energy. And what happens is the light comes down from the sun or from any light source, and it hits an object like, I don't know, a green apple. And what happens is the full spectrum of light hits the apple, and because of the constituents of the apple and the chemical constituents of the apple, only the green elements of the spectrum of color is bounced back. And what it does is that green light and those photons carrying the message of the green light, because, of course, the green light is nowhere. The photons then hit the eye, the retina, and hit the back of the eye, the retina. When they do that, they are converted. Now, again, another interesting point here is photons don't travel in the way that a normal solid object would do. What happens is the signal is transferred from photon to photon. As photons hit other photons, they'll carry the message. All right, billiard balls, you know, you bang a billiard ball against one and then the billiard ball continues. Photons work in that way. So every time they hit an atom or any time they hit an object, it ejects another photon. So effectively, if there's an atom and a photon is coming along carrying the green message and it hits an atom, what the atom does is it takes in that energy and then spouts it out again. So there's a whole series of changes going on before it even hits your eye, when it leaves the apple. So it hits your eye and it goes into the back of your eye, and at the back of your eye is a tiny area called the retina. And the retina is photosensitive. So the retina is able to convert the message in the photon or the light elements into an electric signal. So it's already changed. And the image on the back of the retina is postage stamp sized and inverted. So imagine the visual signal that you are seeing this world in effectively starts as a postage sized inverted image on a retina. That is then converted into a signal, an electric signal, which then goes to the visual cortex, and the visual cortex then takes that signal and reconverts it into an image. And it reconverts that image into, from a postage stamp inverted image, into a three-dimensional image that you're now seeing, that's all around you and everything else. And it's sparkling and it's colourful and everything, but that's what it's created from. Now, what is again incredibly strange about how our perception works, there's something called a binding problem. And this is, if you ever want to really upset a neurologist who thinks that, you know, we know everything about reality, just mention the binding problem, because they get very concerned about this. They don't tend to talk about it a lot for obvious reasons. And the obvious reasons are, you see say I throw the apple in the air that we're talking about, the green apple, and it bounces down the road in front of you. You have a simultaneous feeling of seeing a green apple bouncing down the road. But the green is being processed in the visual cortex. The movement of the apple is being processed in a completely different part of the brain. And then indeed, the sound of the apple making the noise is processed in a different part of the brain. But we have this feeling of simultaneity. We feel that we're seeing an object bouncing down. But different parts of the brain are communicating to create that overall effect. and they need to communicate with each other. Now, the signals within the brain, they're not as fast as even sound waves. They take time to get from one part of the brain to the other. Now, if they were all working in tandem and presenting information as they received it, we wouldn't have the feeling of simultaneity. The sound would be coming later, the light would be coming in a different time, the color would be processed in a different time. And what happens is they are bound together. This is the binding problem. And they do not know how this works. They really genuinely don't. And now I, in my book, and we can talk about that later, I think it's to do with the glial network in the brain, the astroglials, which we will touch on later. But suffice to say, this means that external reality is not what it seems. Now, we are conscious, sentient beings. But the question is, for a second, just reflect, Chris and Hunter, for instance. You are Chris and you are Hunter. But if you look inwards into yourself, what do you find? Who is Chris and who is Hunter really? You have this feeling of knowing who you are because you've been in your body since the moment of your birth, and it's all you've ever known.
Yes.
But we never actually think, well, hold on a minute. Where do all these memories come from? Where do all these emotions come from? Where do all these feelings come from? And indeed, what is it in my head that's processing all this information? When I said that the light goes into the retina and then goes into the visual cortex, what is it that the light is then presenting it to? If you understand what I mean, the light is presenting it to something. And that something is consciousness. But we've no idea what consciousness is. In the mid-1990s, an Australian philosopher called David Chalmers stood up at the University of Arizona and came up with what he called the hard problem of science. And the hard problem of science is how inside your head, electrons and photons reacting with matter in the brain and chemicals create you, create your hopes, your dreams, your loves, your hates, your love of Mozart. All these things are created from nothing. They are created ultimately from inanimate matter. Where does it come from? I've argued in one of my books, does it mean the addition of one quark within the brain? A group of quarks? Does it mean an electron? Does it mean an atom? And suddenly consciousness just appears as if by magic from nowhere. This is a huge issue. But then we then come back to the idea, well, if we start thinking about consciousness in a different way, we then start thinking, well, what other things do we perceive that's unusual? Time. Time is the only thing I know that is perceived by all of us differently. And it can only be measured. You only ever have a minute of a minute. You can have a pound of apples. So you can take a load of apples and you can weigh them. And you will know that that's a pound of apples. And that's the metric by which we know how many apples there are or the weight of them. But we can only ever have a minute of a minute or an hour of an hour. There is nothing that we can measure the duration of time against that's objective, except our own subjective perception of that time moving. And again, I've argued many times that I think that there is even a subatomic particle of time, and I jokingly call it the chronon. And the idea is that we perceive time differently. It depends upon our mood. Mm-hmm. It depends upon what's happening in the metabolics within the brain, within the body. Mm-hmm. I would guarantee that there will be people out there who have either been in a car crash or had an accident or been given bad news, and suddenly time goes woof. And suddenly it seems that what seems like a minute to somebody observing you, for you it could be an hour. Now, let's extrapolate that. So let's think about this for a second. So I'm in a car crash, and I see that there's going to be a car crash happening. And I wrote a book on this in 2007 called The Labyrinth of Time. So I do the science of this and the philosophy and the quantum mechanics and everything else of it and the neurology of it. But when you're in a car crash, so many people claim that time slows down to such an extent they're able to maneuver the car around the accident. And it's only when they calm down and they start to shake and realize they've survived that something very strange has happened. Now, posit for a second that perception of the driver and the perception of somebody watching them on the roadside, they are both in two different time patterns, aren't they?
Yes.
The person watching the accident doesn't perceive the 20 minutes that the person in the car subjectively felt that it took place. To them, it was just a second. Now, I'll give an example of this from my own experience, or from an experience of somebody I once interviewed. When I first started writing, I didn't have a publisher or anything, and I was doing business contract work. And I got a phone call from a lady. I've always called her Margaret. It's not her real name because I keep her identity safe. But she phoned me up one day, and she was a business recruitment consultant. And she said, "Tony, I've got a vacancy for you. Would you be interested in coming along and talking to me about it?" And I said, "Well, not really, because I'm writing a book." And like most people, she said, "What are you writing about?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know where I'm going with it. I'm interested in deja vu as a phenomenon. And I'm also interested in something called temporal lobe epilepsy. Because temporal lobe epileptics, people who experience temporal lobe epilepsy, have time dilation happening all the time." Mm-hmm. I'm explaining it to them, and she said, "Oh, can we meet up for a coffee?" So I arranged to meet her at a hotel near Gatwick Airport. And she sat down, and she said to me, she said, "The reason I wanted to meet you was that I couldn't say in the office, but I've been recently diagnosed with temporal lobe epilepsy." And she said, "Everything you were telling me was true." And I said, "So how did you first realize?" And she said, "It was an extraordinary experience, changed my life." She was seeing a client, and they were in the canteen of the client's company. And the client had gone away to buy a cup of coffee and a cup of tea and brought it down to the table. And Margaret was sitting opposite her. The client puts the tea down and gives her the coffee and starts to pour the tea. And Margaret said, suddenly there was a snap over her ear, Margaret's ear. And she goes, "What was that?" And then she looked at her friend, the woman, and she was like this. She'd stopped moving. And then she could hear this low humming sound around her. And she said, "I couldn't believe it." And I'm looking at her and I'm looking around, and people have just frozen. And then she said, "The humming sound was weird." And then I looked at my friend again, or the woman again, and she said, she was moving incredibly slowly. And she said, "I watched as the tea was poured down the spout and left the spout of the tea and hit the surface of the tea." And she watched, she said, "It took an hour or so for the tea to fill as I watched this happening." And she then realized that the humming sound she was hearing, get this, were people talking. She moved fast, her metabolism is so fast to the world that slowed down around her.
Yeah, yeah.
And she turned around to me and she said, "I was there watching this happen for days, weeks, months. It could have been a whole lifetime." And then suddenly there was another snap over her ear and the woman went back. And all she'd done is she'd had an absence seizure. A petit mal absence seizure, where as far as the woman was concerned, she just stared at her like that and gone like that. She'd been away for a massive amount of time. I then asked her and I said, "Do you get deja vu sensation?" She said, "Oh God, I get deja vu sensations to die for." She said, "I get deja vu and I know what's going to happen for the next 2 or 3 minutes. I get these precog hits." And later on, remind me, I'll give you another example of how I witnessed a temporal lobe epileptic having a precog. Literally, I saw it happen. So I know these things are genuine and real. So here we have this idea of time dilation. Now, I started reading up about time dilation and what happens in the brain. And it's linked to temporal lobe epilepsy. It's linked to various other neurological conditions. But it's particularly manifested at one time during life. Death, during the near-death experience. Mm-hmm. It's something that is regularly reported when people turn around. It's one of the Moody traits. Raymond Moody was the guy that wrote the famous book on near-death experiences. He came up with about 11 or 12 traits, which I'm discussing in my new book. And one of these is time dilation. Now, the question is, what causes that time dilation? Now, I did some research into the neurology. It's to do with a substance called glutamate, which floods the brain during times of stress. So when you have these time dilation experiences, this is what is taking place. The brain is being flooded by a neurotransmitter called glutamate, and it literally slows down your perception of time. Now, recent research into the brains of dying people have shown not only is glutamate released at the point of death, but also a substance called dimethyltryptamine, which they've recently discovered. Juno Borjigian at the University of Michigan and her associates have discovered DMT, which is the most powerful hallucinogenic substance known to man, in the pineal gland of rats. So we now know it is a neurotransmitter. Well, we suspect it's a neurotransmitter in the brain. That also slows time down. Because people, when they drink ayahuasca, which is a derivative of DMT, but that's what people say. Also, ketamine, which is another substance that's been linked to this, also slows down people's perception of time. So why is it released in the brain at the point of death? It's released at the brain at the point of death for one very important purpose. It's to slow down your perception of time. So remember, I was using the analogy of the car crash. Imagine the scenario: you're watching your mother or your father die. You see them die. You watch them die. But for them, they never get to the point of death. They cheat the ferryman because the chemical release in the brain slows down the perception of time to such an extent, like my friend Margaret, there's enough time for them to live a whole lifetime in those final seconds. So for my hypothesis, I don't need to prove that there's life after death. I don't need to do that. My hypothesis doesn't involve having experiences when you're dead.
Mm.
It involves having experiences while you're still alive and while your brain is still functioning.
Mm.
Not only that, but we now know that there was a guy, this is an extraordinary story, and it's in my new book. Two or three years ago, there was a guy, an elderly guy, who had fallen off a ladder. And they were testing him in an fMRI scan. They were scanning his brain when he had a heart attack and died. For the first time, they had a scan of a human brain at the when they were dying. What happens? There was a huge burst of activity right across the brain. The brain lights up everywhere. Everything is happening in the brain. It's linking up. The banding problem disappears. And everywhere lights up and fires up. That's the near-death experience. For the first time, they actually measured a near-death experience. And then, Gino Borgigin, again, in another experiment with rats, get this, they actually euthanized rats while they were measuring their brain activity. Within seconds of literally the brain starting to die, the brain again goes into hyperactivity. It's bringing out information. And what's that information? It's the brain processing the near-death experience and specifically something called a panoramic life review.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is another of the Moody traits, the idea, my life passed before my eyes.
Yes.
So basically, that's what happens when you die. And I am the only person in the world that's come up with this hypothesis. When I wrote it way back when I wrote my first academic paper, I thought the world would be beating their way to my door. It's not happened. And I'm completely at a loss to understand why it hasn't, because my hypothesis can explain virtually every single extraordinary experience that people have in one way or another. So that's basically the cheating ferryman hypothesis and how we never die. Because I argue that the panoramic life review, when you live it in a real death experience, is a literal reliving of your life, second by second. But the difference is, the second time you live your life, there's a part of you that knows you've lived this life before. And that mm-hmm. part of you can change your life pattern, can change the route of your life, can make your life completely different. And again, we can come on to the mechanism by why that works later. This is all just hypothesis, but it's backed by science.
Do you want to? Do you have anything? Okay. And you mentioned a phenomenon too that is basically a life review within a life review, right?
Yeah.
Could you describe what that entails?
Yes. Okay. The idea is that it's going to get quite technical here.
That's okay.
Which tends to, so bear with me on this.
Yeah, sure.
There is generally believed by quantum physicists and by individuals who are cosmologists, there's something very strange about the universe. 94% of the universe is missing. The remainder is either dark energy or dark matter. Now, we don't know what dark energy is and we don't know what dark matter is. The only reason we know about dark matter and dark energy is basically the way in which the galaxies revolve. a lady called Vera Rubin did some research on how galaxies revolve, because, you know, you see like the Andromeda galaxy, it's like a spiral, and they evolve round. But they revolve in the wrong way. They should be faster in the middle and slower further out, but it's the opposite. And as Vera Rubin said, it looks as if there's a vast amount of matter or something surrounding the galaxy to accommodate the way it's moving. And they call that dark matter. The same thing comes with dark energy. They've no idea what they actually are. They're not dark because they're dark. They're dark because we've no idea what they are. Now, the other great mystery of cosmology is black holes and how black holes function. Now, again, without getting technical, and in one of my previous books, I go into the technical detail of this in detail. But effectively, black holes are strange things. Like if you throw your mobile phone into a black hole, something very strange happens, which is beyond our understanding of modern science. The universe is supposed to be an enclosed system. There's nothing outside of it, and it's expanding into nothing, really. But also, the second law of thermodynamics in physics says that matter and energy cannot be lost. They can only be transformed into something else. So if I take a phone that's full of data and information and I throw it into a black hole, that information is lost to the universe completely and utterly, which completely is not how science believes it to be. So what people like Stephen Hawking and his associates have argued is that that information is, when it goes into a black hole, is smeared along the edge of the black hole. Digitally, it's converted into digital energy, which is smeared along the edge of the black hole. They then started extrapolating from this about energy, about information and how information has physical presence. And they came to the conclusion, this is extraordinary. And how they did this, I don't know, but bear with me here. When the Big Bang started, the universe is expanding outwards and has been expanding outwards now for, 14 billion years, something like that. And it's like a huge, it's like a balloon being inflated, isn't it? It's going outwards. Now imagine that the universe, the edge of the universe is like an inflated balloon. That's the inside edge of the inflated balloon. Now, the smallest possible area, according to physics, that you can have is something called the Planck square. Mm-hmm. I use the term Planck, not Planck, because he's German. So it's based on Max Planck, but in German it's called Planck. People criticize me for that, but I'd like to be right.
Of course.
So the smallest possible bit of space is called the Planck length. Now, if you then take the Planck thing at the smallest bit and you expand it in a line and then you turn it into a square, it's the Planck square. Now, they calculated that if the edge of the universe, each bit Planck square contains one bit of information, how much information would you think you would need in terms of bits to encode a universe digitally? Then they calculated how many Planck squares there would be on the inside edge of the universe. It's the same number. And they said, this is too coincidental. I don't know how they did it, but they said it's too coincidental. Yes, there was a guy called Jacob Bekenstein, an Israeli physicist, was the guy that did a lot of this work, and a guy called Juan Maldacana, who I think is Argentinian. But effectively, they said, this is too much of a coincidence. Is the universe actually digital? Is the universe actually what we think is a physical universe out there? Remember I was going about how we perceive things? So is the physical universe out there actually a hologram? And is it being processed by our brain? Because a guy called David Bohm, way back in the 1970s, an Anglo-American physicist, came out with something called the implicate and explicate orders. And Bohm knew Einstein. Okay, so, you know, he's a really serious physicist. And he came to that similar conclusion. So in reality, it looks like it could be holographic in nature. If it's holographic in nature, it's highly likely it's a program. And if it's a program, what does that tell us about reality? Because it's also been argued that the brain works holographically. And a guy called Carl Prubrum, at the University of Princeton came up with the idea of the brain works holographically. Because if the brain worked holographically, that would get over the binding problem I mentioned earlier. Because it would mean that each part of the brain is in instantaneous communication with every other part. Because as you know, in a holographic image, you break a holographic image apart, you don't get bits like a jigsaw puzzle. You actually get a denuded image of the whole image.
Yes.
But within a hologram, each part contains the whole.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, reality is starting to look a bit strange. So suddenly, we have a holographic brain processing a holographic universe. We're almost like we're a universe processing, we are a computer processing information. Now, it is also now believed that everything at its basis is mathematical and information. Again, a guy called Max Tegmark, the University of Princeton, wrote a book a few years ago called Our Mathematical Universe, which makes exactly this point. So where am I going with this? Well, effectively, towards the end of his life, Stephen Hawking wrote a paper with his associate, a guy called Frank Thomas Hertog of CERN, and they wrote a paper together, and they put together their argument, which they called the top-down, the interactional, is it the interactional top-down? Top-down hypothesis of quantum mechanics. And in this, they argued that at the first moment of the Big Bang, every outcome of every subatomic action and every decision anybody can make is already programmed in the machine. It's already programmed in the whatever this is running on. Every single outcome of every single decision, which means that every outcome of every decision that you can make in your life already exists there. All you have to do is technically collapse the wave function of that reality and bring the subatomic particles that make up that reality into existence to move your life in a completely different path to the time you did before. So what I argue is when we die, we go into what I call the Bohmian IMAX. It's in deference to David Bohm. And it's a joke. It's a little in-joke because there's a very famous philosopher called Daniel Dennett, who's an limited materialist, in the sense that Dennett doesn't even believe that we think. We're fooling ourselves into even thinking we exist. And he wrote a very hubristic book many years ago called Consciousness Explained. Hubris writ large, he thinks. Written by a man that doesn't believe there's any inner life. I don't know who, I don't know who Daniel Dennett thinks lives off his royalties. I really don't. But anyway, so going back, so, and he came up with a term he called the Cartesian theater. And I argue that Dennett's Cartesian theater isn't what reality is about. It's not a Cartesian theater. It's a Bohmian IMAX. It's an IMAX that is much greater. And this is how the brain creates that internal, external image you see out of that small image. It's extrapolating the information. It's adding information to it to create effectively a visual and a sensory world that you are downloading as you live it. And it's like you are living within a virtual reality. Imagine you're in a virtual reality feedback suit with a virtual reality headset on. And you're existing within that virtual reality. And your decisions change the roles of the game. Because, of course, we know from virtual reality games, and we've known for years when you play online computer games, that's what happens, doesn't it? You play the game and you get killed. And you go back and you start again. And then you explore a little bit other parts of the game. And I argue that all of us have the game player. And the game player is the daemon. I call it the daemon. It's, again, a Gnostic term.
Yes.
And that's the real you. That is your universal you. That is what you, some people would call the soul. I've just recently come back from southern India, and I was doing a lot of research in southern India about Vedantic beliefs. This very much resonates with Vedanta. It relates with Buddhism. It relates to Zoroastrianism. There's a lot of belief systems that have this as the truth behind. And what it takes place is this game player literally is the real you. You are an Eidolon in the game. You just live once. We all live once. But the daemon lives time and time again over various lives. And over various lives, like Connors does in the movie Groundhog Day, he changes every life, or it changes every life or every day to accommodate what's going on.
And it depends on whether your doors of perception are open as to whether your daemon can commute with the effect, how effective your daemonic communication is. And this is where I come back again to temporal lobe epilepsy, classic migraine, schizophrenia, autism, Alzheimer's, Gerfrand syndrome. These are elements where the doors of perception are open and the daemon can communicate more effectively. But ordinarily, to a neurotypical person, the doors of perception are locked closed. But the daemon can try and communicate in dreams, can communicate giving you a feeling that something's not right. You know, in your life, you meet somebody and you just have this person feels wrong. Or conversely, you meet somebody and you go, wow, this person's going to be so important to me in my life and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. That's the daemon, because the daemon knows this person's going to be because it remembers from last time. And the final clue to us living in the Bohmian IMAX is the most common psychic phenomenon known in the world, and nobody knows why it happens. Deja vu. Deja vu is literally what it feels like. You have lived this moment before. And that's why certain people have precognitive deja vu experiences. Now, there will be people out there, I know, who will turn around and say, oh, come on. What would Efron in 1962 in his visual pathways theory proved for deja vu is literally just the delay in the left and right hemisphere processing things. Most people are not aware of the fact, but a few years ago, a guy called Akira O'Connor at the University of Leeds discovered that people who were born congenitally blind have deja, and I think it's deja something, where they hear something and hear it again.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain processes for hearing is completely different to the brain processes for vision. So that's out of the water. And they cannot explain, even any of the theories neurologically can explain how somebody who has a deja vu sensation sees the future. And people do. So whereas my hypothesis explains that. It's simple. It's what is happening. You've lived it before.
So, and I don't want to, you don't have anything. I don't want to keep going and.
No. And, I'll tell you when.
Okay. Okay. There's a lot to unpack there. So we are living as our lives over and over again. But does the context change? I mean, as we look forwards, well, actually backwards, at history, at things that have happened and times that have happened, inventions that have taken place, epochs, eras, do those things not exist, or is there sort of a backdrop that we get placed within during these lives that keep looping?
They exist because the to use a quantum physics term, the wave function of those historic realities has already been brought into existence. Every person that has ever lived has the same scenario. So therefore, historically, for instance, there will be a part of your life where you'll have been born somewhere completely different, and that will exist because your parents may have made a decision to move somewhere else or not move somewhere else. Like my parents were going to live in Australia, and had my grandmother not been ill, there is a reality that I would have been Australian and born in Australia, and my life would have been a very different life. But it goes back throughout history. So their parents, their grandparents, their great parents, they're all making decisions now. And this is where we need to start to break out of it a little bit. And this is where the next section comes in. It is that if you assume there's the, now remember, and I keep stressing this, do I believe this? I don't know. I'm not some kind of guru. This is just what the science is telling me. It doesn't mean it's real. It just means taking into account what the science says, this is a reasonable hypothesis, and it's as reasonable as any other. But say we have at the moment the eidolon that lives one life. Then you have the daemon that lives your life many times. But then I argue, now I do the neurology through split brain operations and various other things about how there's two loci of consciousness within the human brain. That has been proven through split brain operations. Nobody questions this. Cut the corpus callosum, you get two people. Fact. Okay. So what we then need to understand is, well, there's the daemon and the eidolons. The daemon lives many, many lives. But is that where it ends? And I don't believe it is. And how I prove this is very difficult scientifically. But just bear with me on this. I argue that what is happening is above the daemon is something I call the uberdaemon. And the uberdaemon is my equivalent of the Jungian collective unconscious. It's the memory system of all human beings, maybe even all sentient beings. And the uberdaemon, just like the daemon, has all your previous lives in its own brain, in its own mathematical structure of information. The uberdaemon has the information of all of humanity. And this is how I explain past lives. One of the major criticisms of cheating the ferryman is, well, people get hypnotized and have past lives. People go back in, people claim that they have visions and dreams of being somewhere and somewhere else. If you just live the same life again, how can that happen? Because it's not reincarnation. It is literally reincarnation, but reincarnation as yourself. But at the uberdaemon level, reincarnation is a truth because the uberdaemon contains the memories of all humanity. So once somebody is hypnotized and regressed back to a previous life, what happens is they attune from the daemon consciousness into the uberdaemon consciousness. And they log in like a radio, like you pick on a radio signal. And you pick up on the life of somebody living in 14th century York, as one example. You know, the lady who was killed in the massacre of the Jews in 1215 or whatever it was. So what happens is it's not really you, but you're tuning into an information field, which is what Blavatsky and everyone call the Akashic Record.
Yes, yeah.
What Irvin Laszlo, who I wrote a book with a few years ago, calls the Akashic Field. Mm-hmm. This, is, again, can be placed down to quantum mechanics. It's to do with the zero-point field and zero-point energy, but I don't have time to go into that now. So then you have the uberdaemon, and of course Carl Jung said there's the Jungian archetypes. There's archetypes we see and everything else that we see. And in Jungian typology, you know, this is how our memories work. This is why we have archetypes and why we have irrational fears. It's how we explain epigenetics, how it is that we have certain things that we just know instinctively, even though we can't ever know them. Like the argument that a young, newly born bird of a particular species will cringe if you put a cardboard cutout of a hawk over them. It's just being born. But it knows. And it knows because it's tuning into the uberdaemon. Okay? Now, so we have the uberdaemon, but that's not where I stop. Because then I argue that above that is the godaemon. And the godaemon is it's the universal consciousness. It's the information field that everything is working on. It's like a huge conscious computer. It's what Tom Campbell calls the UAR, I think it is, or something like that, the thought field that is everything. Mm-hmm. Now, this again, going back to basic theology here, within the Vedanta in India, they have a concept called Brahman. Brahman is thought. Brahman is everything. We are all emanations of Brahman. This is the whole thing of Hinduism. Is to be born again and again to discover the God within, to discover that you are God. This is the same in Buddhism. The idea of a singularity that we are all part of. Then you have within the Kabbalah, you have the All Ein Sof, which is the backdrop of everything. And, you know, so, and within Sufism, within Islam, it's the same concept. They have the same ideas. The secret of all religions, it's what Aulus Huxley called a perennial philosophy. Is that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. We have individuation because we have egos. But we are not an eidolon. We are not a daemon. We are not a uberdaemon. we are all just emanations of the Goedemon. And the Goedemon is the information field that everything runs upon. Now, again, if anybody's interested, there'll be people listening to this that go, and I've heard this before. And it's true. If you go online and look up the American comedian Bill Hicks, the late, great Bill Hicks, I don't know if you know his monologue.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, we love him.
Yeah. Here's the news. It's Bill and his Bill but the news. Bill but the weather. We are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, and matter is just energy walked down to walking pace. Now, this is true. This is something we all instinctively know. And this is why when people first come across my work, there's something inside them, the daemon, the golden one, and it goes bing. And they go, shoot, this is how it is. This is how it is. This is how it's always been. And all I'm trying to do is to do the science of this. Now, I didn't set up, when I started writing my book, I just wanted an explanation for deja vu. I didn't expect to find all these things. I didn't expect to be going into the further reaches of quantum mechanics to understand Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and the idea of the collapse of the wave function. Because again, within quantum mechanics, a particle is literally a wave of probability until it is measured. It is nowhere and everywhere until it is measured or a consciousness perceives it, and it collapses from a wave function, which is basically a statistical wave function. It's not like a wave in water. It's a mathematical wave function, which is an idea. It's a mathematical idea, which then collapses by the act of observation of a conscious being into a solid particle. And of course, everything we perceive around us is made up of these particles that come into existence by the act of observation. Now, again, everything we see out there, we think is solid. We think it's real. We think I bang my hand on the table. That table is 99.999999999996 empty space. And the bits that are physical in there are the quarks and the electrons. And the quarks and electrons themselves are what's called point particles, which means they have no extension in space. However much you zoom in, there is no extension in space. So they have no physical reality. So even the things that we think make up matter have no physical reality. There is nothing out there, nothing, except what we perceive is out there. But we don't co-perceive all this, and that's why it's real. It's consensual reality. So I can't change reality by thinking I want to change it. Because you're creating it. Everybody around, I'm looking out my window now, there's cars driving down the road. They're all consciousnesses creating this. So it's a consensual reality. I call it the egregorial reality. The idea that we co-create our anticipations. But it doesn't mean like New Age wacko stuff saying, oh, if you think positively, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. It's far more complex than that. But in basis, the basics are correct. It's just how people interpret them. So this means that, is this how we create ghosts? Is this how, you know, for instance, in one of my books, my previous book was about non-human entities. And if anybody's interested on this, and it'd be really great if some of you guys could get along, but I'll be speaking at Contact in the Desert at the end of May, from May the 30th to the 3rd of June, Indian Wells in California. And I'm doing an event every day on that.
Fantastic.
And I'll be discussing a lot of these themes. And it was interesting last year, because when I turned up there, nobody really knew who I was. And I did my first talk, and it was just sort of everybody wanted to talk to me. It was just astonishing how 1 minute they'd never heard of me, the next minute, wow, this is mind-blowing.
That's great.
And this is why I've been invited back, you know, because they want to continue with the ideas. And on that, if anybody again is interested, I'm doing an intensive on the Monday, a three-hour intensive on the writings of Philip K. Dick, the American science fiction writer, who I wrote a biography of a few years ago.
Fantastic.
So I'm rabbiting on here, but there's so much information I need. Point, because everything I say has to be supported.
Absolutely.
One way or another.
Yeah, we just had Tessa Dick on not too long ago.
Oh, she's lovely, Tessa, isn't she? I hope she's okay. She's had a hard time of it.
Yeah,
She really has.
She's tough as nails, though. She's very resilient.
Oh, totally. You know, yes. She was so helpful when I wrote my book on Phil.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, I got some information from her that people talk about that never really happened because she was the only witness to them, except mm-hmm. for Phil. And of mm-hmm. course, Phil was a fiction writer and did yes. tend to embroider a little bit.
Yeah, and he was prophetic too, I believe, in a lot of ways.
He was indeed.
So, predestiny. What you are alluding to is there's not a mono predestiny. There's a predestiny that involves lots of different possibilities.
Yeah, it's very much an application of, in many ways, Hugh Everett III's 1957 PhD thesis, when there's something called Schrödinger's cat, which is a thought experiment put forward by Schrödinger to disprove the idea of the relationship between the act of observation and subatomic particles come into existence, which is the Copenhagen interpretation of Max Born and Niels Bohr. And he said, you know, you lock a cat in a box and inside is a file full of poison and there's a little hammer and in any hour period, there's a sensor attached to a subatomic particle that may or may not decay. And if it decays, the hammer comes down, smashes the file, poison comes out, and the cat's dead. But according to applying the Copenhagen interpretation, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time until you open the box and observe it. And this was quite an issue. But Hugh Everett III came up with another proposition. And he said, yeah, but there's a live cat and a dead cat in there at the same time. And when the box is opened, the scientist splits into two scientists. One scientist sees a dead cat and one scientist sees a live cat.
Interesting.
Now, initially, this was a thought experiment, but since then, there's been work done suspicious that Everett was right, that what's called the many worlds interpretation is the correct way of seeing the universe. And the reason why people say this, and again, this is fascinating. In my first book, I discussed something called the cosmic anthropic principle. And the cosmic anthropic principle, in straightforward terms, was put forward by, I can't remember their names now, but a couple of guys wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, they argue that if you look at the universe from the first moments of the Big Bang, John Wheeler was one of them, I think. And all the series of amazing coincidences that happened by chance to ensure that we evolved, that consciousness evolved. Even like in the first femtosecond of the Big Bang, matter and antimatter there was slightly more matter than antimatter. There was no reason for that. They should have been equal. If it hadn't been equal, if it had been equal, they would have destroyed each other in the first microsecond and the universe would never have started.
Mm-hmm.
So from there onwards, there's to do the atoms and the molecules come together to create hydrogen. It's incredible. And it's time after time, these billion to one chances, one after the other, all happened to allow human beings to evolve. For instance, even things we know now, water. Water is the only liquid that freezes from the top downwards. Hmm. Every other liquid does it the other way around.
Interesting.
Water doesn't. And if water had, there would be never freestanding water on the Earth and would never, ever have evolved because there wouldn't have been the H2O to allow life to start.
Hmm.
So even little things like that. Now, there's a counter argument here to say, oh, come on, it's because the universe has to be this way for us to be there to be observing it. There was a very famous joke that Douglas Adams put in one of his books about a puddle lying in the ground. And the puddle turns around to itself and thinks, isn't it extraordinary? This hole I'm in perfectly fits my shape. And that was his way of mocking the hypothesis of the cosmic anthropic principle. As somebody once said, you know, cosmic anthropic principle, and they put another letter and it was CRAP. But there was more to this.
because the pull model doesn't work, because the pull exists and it was existing in some ways. So there's not that argument. But the only way that scientists who do not believe that consciousness collapses the wave function and that we are in some way consciousness is important is to come up with the many worlds interpretation. Because the many worlds interpretation says that there are trillions and trillions and trillions of planet Earths and trillions of each of us. And there are zillions and zillions of histories that lead up to the development of this planet. And each collapse of each wave function creates a different planet. Now, it's not at all surprising we exist in a planet that's ideal for life, because there are trillions of other ones where they're not. Whereas if there's only ever been one universe and they got it and got it right first time, that is beyond belief. But if there are billions of universes and we happen to be in the one where we are, that's not at all surprising. And that's why a lot of the people who don't like the consciousness role go for the many worlds interpretation. But what it means is, by denying the role that consciousness creates the world, we have to believe that there are trillions and trillions of worlds. And nobody knows the mechanism by which all this matter is appearing.
Yes.
From nowhere to accommodate it. Mm-hmm. But if matter is digital and it's made up of mass, it doesn't need to be physical. It's numbers. And of course, you can copy photographs time and time again, can't you? Take a digital photograph and copy a complete copy of it. And all that's used is energy. And, you know, a lot of the digital information we have, you know, it is the argument, where is the internet? You know, there's all that information around us on the cloud. But it's not just digital information. And so when you go on put a virtual reality headset on and you're in this virtual reality world, it's not real. It's digital information. So why could it not be that what we're perceiving now could not be digital information in exactly the same way? Right.
If before you sign off, would you tell the people watching or listening where they can find you and your work?
Yeah, my work is everywhere. So, well, everywhere and nowhere, I suppose, a bit like egregores. my books, you can order my books from any bookshop you want to go into. But I also say to people, if you don't want to buy the books, just please, please go to your local library and order a copy. Some libraries, even in the States, will have copies of my books. Mm-hmm. I'm not out there to get people to buy my books. I'm out there for people to understand what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the money would be nice, but that's not why I do it. So library, but you can get my books in bookshops. You can also get my books off Amazon on all the major online sellers. And most of my books are also in Audible and in Kindle, and I read them, with the exception of the Philip K. Dick book. I had to audition to read my own books, which is interesting. Yeah, you have to have a right kind of tonality, and you have to be able to read properly. So I had to audition. But I passed the audition. So that was
thank goodness.
So now it means that people go to sleep listening to me droning on and on and on, which is a really strange thing to do. And I get messages from people around the world saying, I go to sleep listening to you. And I think, yes, I'm quite soporific. Probably not. So if you're interested in signed copies, you can buy them directly off my website.
Cool.
Again, I probably, if you are based in America, unless you desperately want my signature, I wouldn't do that, because the cost of the postage is actually now greater than the cost of the book.
Wow.
But if you want the signature, please do.
Fantastic.
Just check them out. But also, just don't take my word for anything I've said. In my books, there are pages and pages and pages of references. Read it and make up your own mind. I'm not a guru. I'm nobody special. I'm just somebody that has an idea. The idea is what it germinates and stimulates in your mind that's important, not what I have to say. Because after all, this is your life, not mine, and you're going to live it many times.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to sit and chat with us. If you could just make sure before you sign out of your...
You forgot to tell him to tell the listeners where they can find him.
Oh, I he did the book part, but he didn't do the website part.
My website is anthonypeake.com.
Gotcha.
And also Anthony Peake, if you just do a search on Anthony Peake on YouTube, there's around about 120 interviews I've done with people. Most of the areas I've discussed, I actually interview the academics involved as well. So check that out.
Cool.
And, you know, there's lots of really interesting stuff on there. Plus, of course, the Rebecca Sharrock incident with the Harry Potter novel. That's well worth checking out. And I've actually put a short 5-minute segment for that, so you don't need to watch the whole interview.
Cool. Well, we'll have those links in the episode notes for sure.
Okay.
Fantastic meeting you, sir. And I will let you know when this comes out.
Absolutely.
All right.
I used to work for a company called Riverside, so I was quite confused when you said you'd uploaded it to Riverside. I said, what, you've sent it to my old Riverside address?
Exactly. This is your life. You still work for us. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Take care, sir. Great meeting you. And we'll be in touch and have you on again for sure.
It was an honor and a pleasure to meet you, Anthony. Thank you so much.
You guys too. You guys too. I really appreciate it.
Mind sufficiently blown?
Yeah, he was amazing.
He did not disappoint.
No, he was really, really great.
Yeah. I mean, we've heard his name bandied about time and time again through different people that we've had on. And just in passing, people, listeners, Patreons, people on Locals have brought him up. Actually, a couple of days ago, somebody said, you guys should have Anthony Peake on. And I said, we're on it. He's going to be on in a couple of days. So, finally reading his book or listening to his book, Cheating the Ferryman, mind-blowing stuff, really incredible. Very sciencey. Some of it lost me, but the concepts, the basic concepts that all of the science was, what's the word I'm looking for? Attempting to explain was amazing stuff. I still have tons of questions. I mean, you can always tell it's a great interview when I kind of forget about my list of questions that I've worked so hard to put together and just kind of wing it organically with whatever comes up. So it was amazing.
Yeah. And also in situations like this, I just want to let that person go. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want them to speak. You know,
absolutely.
Because there's so much, I don't feel like we even needed to ask. He was another Frankie Fearless. We didn't even need to ask a question. We just let him go and he went there. I really, really liked this interview. It was amazing. It was so amazing. I'm still kind of processing and I have a little ambient headache a little bit right now and hungry. Sorry. And My mind was not, I started to fall asleep, but it was because I was so, my energy was dropping, but I was so interested in what he was saying that I was hanging on. I kept kind of fidgeting and trying to move to wake myself up because it was so good and I didn't want to miss any of it.
Yeah. As you all don't know, we had to wake up earlier than, I mean, I wake up early for my work anyway, but not usually to have such a mind altering interview conversation. I'm usually just doing whatever the house that I'm working on needs to have done to it. But so, yeah, we're not usually in our top form because before our business hours usually start.
Yeah,
so,
for sure. Yes. But I was so happy to have him and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I had questions, but I just wanted to kind of, he speaks in a way where he's like stacking ideas and concepts. And so I didn't want to interrupt that flow. Yeah, I wanted him to just keep going because it was so good.
Exactly. That's why I was scribbling notes the whole time and didn't even really get to a lot of those either. But yeah, I know what you mean. Like he's just keeps throwing things out, giving you a whole warehouse of boxes to unpack.
Yeah. I mean, we could have done the whole show on his mom and that experience. Yeah. That was mind blowing. Mm-hmm. Like just so amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Great, great stuff. He will definitely be back.
For sure.
Wonderful, intelligent, charming person.
Just so, so smart. You know, I like that these are concepts that we talk about with the kids too. Mm-hmm. The idea of multiverses and multiple timelines. And I think the thing that's interesting about that is that maybe it is just this one Groundhog Day life that we're living, but the beauty of that movie and the thing that makes that movie so important to me and such a magical film is that you see someone go through this transition and how painful it is for the people around that person to be dealing with this kind of asshole. And then when the light clicks on for him and he recognizes what's happening and he starts to do the right thing and really use his energy in the best way possible, what you see is how everything around him changes. Mm-hmm. Even though he's experiencing the same events for 6,000 days, his relationship with those events change. And so the people around him change too.
Yeah, exactly. Which lends itself to everything being interconnected, which it totally is. Yeah, and it brought together lots of different concepts that we've discussed with different people on the show. Egregores, simulation theory, life after death, consciousness being something that isn't necessarily limited to the brain, but bringing it together in a different context that I don't think anybody's discussed nearly as uniquely as he has proposed in his book.
Yeah, I would go to the desert just to see his talks. I mean, I'm sure they're going to be amazing.
Yeah, one every day for 3 days. That's great. Like, obviously, he properly blew everybody's mind the last year that he was there. And they were like, we need to give this guy more airtime because he's on to something for sure.
Yeah.
If anything, he's just a great articulator of ideas and concepts.
Yes. And once again, I want to thank G for putting him on our radar because she is the person who brought him up initially in one of our monthly meetups. And I am very grateful for that because we've received lots of great nudges from G.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it took some poking and prodding to finally get this on the ground and running, but I knew it would be totally worth it. So I completely forgot when I booked it and we came up with a time that Britain does not have time.
Daylight
savings time, yes. Yeah. So we were there an hour early going, well, what's going on? I really want to talk to him.
Yeah, I'm so glad we waited.
Yes.
That's very unlike us. We're very impatient people. Mm-hmm. We can be. But that was good that we hung out and waited for him.
Exactly.
It was so worth it.
It would have sucked to got to work and then hear from him going, oh, God. I will be on in 5 minutes.
Like, oh, my God. No. I know.
Yeah, we would have missed that incredible conversation, but it would have just waylaid it, and we would have had another great one later on down the line.
But the time thing, that was so, it's just all so fucking amazing. And I don't know that I want the DMT space to be more real than this reality.
Well, I mean, the way that I posited that, and I'm not obviously the only one that's ever done that, was that is a world. I mean, I guess in this narrative, it would be outside of the holograph. So, or the hologram. I always get those two terms confused. So it's a different resolution than what we're going to be able to process with our senses. Our senses that are grounded in physical reality. Because you're in a different realm. So you're on a different wavelength, different frequency, different resolution. So interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Yes. But I need to keep it short because.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's so, what's cool is, you know, we have talked a lot on the show about our connection and our paths crossing at different points in our lives and how many times we were probably in the same room together at a party or at an event and we didn't realize it. And that this consistent with this idea that you get on this timeline when it's like the right one or the appropriate one or the most auspicious one. And I feel like that's what happened with us, mm-hmm. is that it, and we've actually had that conversation before, that maybe we wouldn't have been ready for each other when I was 18 and you were 20. Yeah. Like, we needed to go through this process and this life span apart and then come together at this point. And maybe we tried that other way before and it didn't work.
Perhaps. Like the Black Mirror episode with the dating thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or not the dating thing, but like the relationships were pre-programmed.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what the plot twist was, which made it all, put it into context. But at the
end, you didn't get to choose if the thing said it was right for you to be with that person, you had to be with that person. If you liked somebody, but, and you weren't supposed to be together, yeah. then
no, I know that part. I know the premise of the plot, but there was a twist at the end where they kind of, I think that it amounted to them transcending that whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. They got out of it.
Yes.
They got out of that space. Yeah.
So we just got out of it.
I'll take it.
Okay.
All right, peoples.
Thank you so much for listening or watching, whichever the case may be. This is... She said this was a guest that was suggested by a patron of ours, but if you are not a patron or you are a patron, we are open to guest suggestions. You can send them to themeltpodcast@protonmail.com or?
Yeah, just do that. Don't send me any guest requests. I'm not good about that, but
just
you can send me other things.
If you want advice, psychological advice on your love life, on your kitchen arrangement, feng shui readings, consultations. Anyway, much love to you all. Hopefully you gleaned something off of this. I thought it was incredible.
So it was.
Hopefully you guys are impressed too.
Yeah, it was totally worth it.
All right. Farewell.
All right.
Ta-ta.
Meow.
Thanks so much for making it this far. If you've liked what you've heard and are thus inspired to contribute to the well-being of The Melt, there are a few easy ways to do that. The most tangible being financially, which can be achieved by clicking the Locals or Patreon link in the episode notes, and then you will be led through the process of starting your monthly subscription for a mere $5 a month. This will give you access to exclusive episodes, full-length episodes, and you can participate in our monthly Melt meetups, where we can congregate together as a community and often get a chance to chat with some of our guests more intimately. Another way to help out would be to go to wherever it is that you listen to The Melt and leave a favorable review or rating. You can also spread the word via sharing or recommendation to friends and family, either in person or virtually. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.